You're listening to episode 18 of season 8 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is the GNU World Order, in which we talk about Unix, Linux, GNU, BSD sometimes, and other things, specifically EFI in this episode. So we're going to be talking about, well, a lot of different things in this episode. We'll talk a little bit about a Git UI front-end, talk about some autofill tricks in Emacs, a menu, how to make menus in Emacs and Lisp, an intro to Lisp, not in this podcast. I'm just going to mention, oh, by the way, there's an intro to Lisp somewhere out there online. And we'll talk a little bit about some misconceptions of open source and what it means, and then of course, we will talk about Theano Core EFI running in QEMU. It'll be a really good time, so stay tuned. Okay, so first, we, as always, will take some listener feedback. I didn't get a whole lot of listener feedback this time, probably because the previous episode was a fake. I really kind of phoned that one in. But this one's a really good one. But either way, probably this episode, the 19th episode, or the next episode, and then the final episode of this season will all be recorded kind of in advance. So even if I get listener feedback, I anticipate not having much feedback in those episodes. So if you're going to give me feedback, maybe don't, or don't count on hearing it on the show, because you probably won't. I will always email you, though. I always email back when people send me feedback, and if I don't, then it's an egregious error on my part, not on yours, or not anything that you've done personally. So anyway, listener feedback this episode from my friend and your friend of the show, Harley. Harley says that he is working on being a web developer type and learning Ruby and a bunch of cool stuff like that. Really, really neat stuff that he's been working on. But specifically, and he's written in about Git before, he did the, if you'll recall, there was this bash RC trick of making your bash prompt actually reflect the state of the Git branch that you are in at that moment in your shell. Pretty neat. Don't think I'd use it myself, but pretty cool nevertheless. He emailed me recently about something called TIG, and some developer came up with this idea of an incurses-based interface, user interface, front-end for Git. He said that he wasn't a big fan of most UIs for Git. He finds them convoluted and confusing, and he just doesn't really use them. So he uses the command line primarily for Git, but has invented or developed TIG, T-I-G, as a text mode incurses-based UI for Git. In short, it is the mutt to your Outlook, the Vim to your Emacs. That's a ridiculous statement. The W3M to your Firefox. Okay, we get it. So TIG is what it sounds like. It's you know, a GUI in so much as you consider incurses a GUI. And there are screenshots on this site, and I will put a link to the blog in which this guy sort of introduces the world to TIG so that you can see for yourself what it does. I will say that I kind of am on the same boat with Antoine, the guy who created TIG. I don't really much like UIs either for Git. I mean, the place where I differ from him, I think, is that I'm not really interested in TIG at all. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I said it as if though I was being rude, but I wasn't really. I learned Git in what I would call a pretty busy production environment. I mean, it was, you know, how you can learn to swim by learning the doggy paddle, and you're kind of treading in the shallow end, and then you kind of venture out in the deep end. Or you can learn to swim by just being thrown into the deep end. That was how I learned Git. I was thrown into it. It was not a question of play around with this thing called Git for a while and learn it and feel comfortable. It was like, here's Git, here are the commands that you need. If you do this wrong, you will break the nightly build and everyone will yell at you. And so I became pretty comfortable on the shell interface for Git, the command line interface. Just that was Git to me, and it always has been. And I don't feel like I don't even feel like I could understand necessarily what a GUI was trying to tell me. And that's the first time that I can think of that's ever really happened to me. I've never actually, that I can think of, I've never learned something in the shell first. I mean, I've learned lots of things in the shell first, but I've never learned something in the shell first and then been introduced to a bunch of GUI options and had this kind of, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like, It's like the difference between, I don't know, seeing in color and seeing in black and white or something, or maybe even more than that. I mean, it really is just a, like, the very constructs of Git to me, I can see them as text output. And if you try to show that to me in a GUI, it starts to actually make less sense to me. And that's kind of an interesting thing, because I've never had such a perceptual difference between two forms of the same technology before. Like, at all. Like, I'll give you another example. I mean, video editing, right? Something that I learned, obviously, in a GUI first, because that's how normal people do it. That's how you really should do it. But there are video editors, or there are video editing things that you can do on the command line, and those two have always been very, very similar to me. There's never been a question of, like, oh my gosh, this is totally different. There's no way to sort of equate these two things. It's always been like, okay, yeah, I get it. Do it by the numbers here, and then you get your output, and you transcode it, or whatever you're doing. It's not really that big of a deal. But Git in the shell versus Git in some fashion, in some form of graphical interface, really, really does seem just totally different to me. Something that I'd never experienced before. Thought I'd mention it. So TIG does exist if you have not learned Git in the shell and feel like you have to think of Git as text commands. And I don't know, I mean, maybe at some point I will sort of warm up to the idea of a graphical interface for Git. Maybe it's just me not wanting to bother right now. It's quite possible, because I've done that before, you know? I mean, I had meant to learn Emacs for ages and just never really had to, so I never really did. And then, of course, I had to for work, and so I learned it, like, really, really in detail. You know, it could just be my own personal disinterest, but I do find it interesting that when I look at one thing, it really doesn't seem to equate all that much for me. It seems to be very, very different. Just an interesting kind of perception footnote there that I'd never experienced before. Okay, so that was listener feedback. That's really all the listener feedback that I got. No, that's not true. There is one more. Sorry. There's one more from Deep Geek. So Deep Geek has been doing an internet radio show, I should say. The place is called radio.pittsburgharts.org. That is radio.pittsburgharts.org. And if you go there, you will hear music. His show is at, I think, 9 until 11 at night. And during the day, there are other shows as well. It typically plays a bunch of independent music. So if you're into independent music, you might want to check it out for that reason as well. So thank you, Deep Geek, for letting us know about that. Next up, we've got a couple of tips and notes about Emacs that I wanted to kind of sneak in. They're just personal notes on Emacs about some cool tricks that I have discovered. A lot of my cool tricks about Emacs in general come from the Emacs Wiki, the official Emacs Wiki. It's emacswiki.org. It's one of the least annoying wikis that I have ever visited. I still don't love the search function on anything, so I still end up searching for it in some internet search engine and then getting there that way. But overall, I find the wiki pretty well structured in comparison to some other wikis that I've seen, which is quite nice. But this particular trick is really neat because it's just really handy. I'm sure there are equivalents in a lot of other things, like a lot of other text editors. There are some, I think, even like OS level things that do this. So, I mean, this kind of thing exists elsewhere. So it's, once again, as many of my tips are not, this is not a, you know, this is why Emacs is better than everything else. It's just a tip about Emacs. If you use Emacs, or if you've been looking for a reason to learn Emacs and think this sounds cool, then hey, check it out, because it's worth it. The Emacs abbreviation mode, I think, is what it's called, or abbreve mode, or abbrev mode, A-B-B-R-E-V-M-O-D-E. And what it does is it auto-expands abbreviations that you yourself decide upon. So, for example, in my HTML stuff that I do, I am very frequently, I treat HTML a lot like DocBook, that's how I think of HTML. Like, when I'm writing documentation in HTML, or notes or blog posts or articles, whatever you want to call them, in HTML, I always think of it as if though I'm writing it in DocBook. So I'll do things like span class equals, for instance, application, or span class equals mono for mono font typeface. Different things like that when I'm typing out like an application name, or I'm referring to a man page, or referring to a certain command within the body of the text. So I find myself typing out these fairly long strings fairly frequently. You know, it's span class equals quote mono quote close tag name of application span. And there are different modes that you can use to help you with that. I mean, I have a lot of auto completion in my Emacs configuration anyway. So like it will, you know, if I start typing in SP, it autofills span, and then I'll hit return, and then I'll return or space CL, and it starts to figure out that I'm saying class, so I'll hit return. But even that's like a lot of interaction. So I wanted a way to just kind of fill in, okay, I'm about to give you an application name now. I want my standard span class equals mono tag. So I would usually just, like if I was writing something, I would copy that string, span class, or open tag, span space class equals quote mono close tag. I would copy it and keep it around in my kill ring so that I could keep yanking it back, you know, really quickly. But even that, like once you start copying and pasting too much stuff, then you have to go through your kill ring and look for it and bring it back. And it just doesn't feel quite natural. So a brev mode is exactly what I was looking for. And this is really, really nice. So what you can do, for instance, is come up with some random string of letters, or not so random, but random enough that you're not going to assign something like a real word. So what I did was come up with just AA would lead my abbreviations. So all of my custom abbreviations were going to be led by double A's. I don't know why I chose that. I just did. And then SCM. So S for span, C for class, M for mono. Simple enough. AASCM. And then I hit Control X, AIG. Just like that. Control X, and then just the letters A, and then I, and then G. And that drops me down in the mini buffer to this abbreviation mode definition. And so it says, global expansion for AASCM. So I can type in open tag span space class equal sign quote mono close quote close tag, and hit return. And sure enough, that expands AASCM to span class equals mono. Obviously that doesn't seem very helpful, but wait, so it's stored that abbreviation. So from now on, whenever you type AASCM return, and it has to have the return after it, you have to hit return, I find pretty much immediately after the AASCM, that autofills, or it converts really AASCM from AASCM to open tag span class equals mono close tag. So it's really, really nice. Two things about this mode that you need to know. One is that when you close and say, or when you close Emacs, it will offer to save all of your new abbreviations into, I think the default is tilde slash, or you know, your home folder slash dot abrev underscore defs. I think that's the default. It might actually be, it may be, depending on your config, your .emacs file, tilde slash elisp.d slash abbrev defs. But the point is that it kind of has a location that it'll try to put it. So I generally let it go there. You can also tell it to save it automatically. You can even define where the abbreviations will live. So if you're not okay with it going into your home folder as a .dot file, maybe you want it in your .emacs.d folder or a .elisp.d folder or wherever you keep your stuff. I just keep it in a folder called elisp. So that's where I put my abbreviations. Wherever you want it, you can do that. You can set Emacs to auto-save them every time you quit. I don't have it auto-save it because for me, I feel like the likelihood of me just coming up with a sort of a, oh, I need this abbreviation for this one document and then I'll never use it ever again, is pretty likely. So I don't have it auto save. But what you do need, or what you would probably want, is a way to restore those abbreviations every time you launch Emacs. So in other words, if you've created a bunch of abbreviations, you've even saved them into your abbreviation file, and then you close Emacs, and then you open it up the next day and type in AASCM or whatever your abbreviation is, it won't expand that. It doesn't automatically read from the abbreviation defs file unless you put in your Emacs, your .emacs configuration file, paren if space paren file dash exists dash p space abrev dash file dash name close paren, and then return tab paren quietly dash read dash abrev dash file paren paren. And that would cause Emacs, if there's an abbreviation file, to read in the abbreviations into its little memory, and that way it's kind of activated, it's ready to go. If you type in AASCM return, it will autofill or expand that rather to span class mono or whatever you've defined it as. If the abbreviation definition file does not exist, then Emacs will still open, it will not complain, it will not crash or give you that annoying sort of split screen where it says, I've opened, but I've had a bunch of errors, so I use that one. So put that into your .emacs file, and remember the command to define an abbreviation is Control X and then AIG. I have no idea how to remember that, I don't know what it stands for, never did. I think there's an insurance company here in the States with that abbreviation, AIG, and that's kind of, for some reason, I keep picturing that in my mind when I think of how do I define an abbreviation. For some reason, this little logo of an insurance company that I think might not even be called AIG pops into my head, and that's how I remember it. So you'll have to come up with some way for yourself to remember AIG. Control X AIG. No clue how you can remember that. But that's how you do it. That's how you define the abbreviation. You do that once, and then from then on, that abbreviation will become whatever you define it to expand to. It's a really, really handy trick. You should check it out if you use Emacs. Okay, the next thing about Emacs that I have isn't really so much a tip as it is sort of an update, sort of a release. As you may or may not know, and I'm not going to go on and on about this because I know that a lot of you, in the nicest way, don't care, but as you may or may not know, I maintain a thing called Screenwriter Mode for Emacs. And Screenwriter Mode lets you write screenplays in Emacs with all the fancy slug lines and the dialogue boxes and transitions and stuff like that. This guy named Frederick emailed me once with this really, really cool patch to Screenwriter, which in itself really is a patch to Screenplay Mode. So Screenwriter Mode, he patched it to correct the alignment of transitions, which was really, really neat. Very cool to get patches to something that I'm maintaining. So that was nice. And then when I was making that patch, when I was like integrating his code into the official code, I decided to try to finally create a little drop-down menu for Screenwriter Mode so that people could, if they're not familiar with how to do screenplays, they would have a little menu, a drop-down menu, that would kind of show them the keyboard shortcuts, or if they just can't remember the keyboard shortcuts or something, they wanted to be really slow, they could go up to the menu, select slug line or action or dialogue or transition so that they could get into the right layout of the Screenwriter, of Screenwriter Mode. I don't know if you know, screenplays have a very distinctive form format, and most industry professionals, and I say most because certainly not all, but most of them use this format because in theory, if you format it this way, then you have a very accurate way of knowing how long your completed movie will be. And so there's a bunch of weird indentations and stuff like that in screenplays, and a bunch of silly conventions that don't really matter, like capitalizing slug lines. It doesn't really all have to be all in caps. Transitions don't really have to be right justified all in caps, but that's just how it is, and a lot of people do that. Not everyone, but a lot of people. So anyway, wanted to come up with a way for people to access those different formatting conventions in an easy, GUI kind of way. So I did a little bit of research and found out how to create menus, which, I mean, I could read the code to you, but it's not going to be very useful because it's all Lisp, and I don't know, if you're like me, you don't know a whole lot of Lisp. I'm in the process of trying to learn more Lisp, since I do maintain a Lisp plugin for Emacs. So yeah, I'm getting there. And it's a really interesting language. Actually, really, really interesting. I'm enjoying it quite a lot. And you know, it's funny when you start, it is true what they say about learning programming languages. You do kind of start to, even if you're not terribly good, like me, I mean, once you start learning them, you do start to see like the common factors that I guess pretty much every programming language or nearly every programming language is going to have, you know, just, I mean, the basics, you know, like variables. And you're just kind of like, okay, I know I want to create a variable. And it's no longer a mystery to you at some point. Like at some point, you now know what a variable is. You understand how they work to whatever degree that you can actually use them. And so you kind of look through the documentation just really for the convention that they use. You know, do I have to instantiate the variable first? If so, how? Do I just randomly create variables? If so, how? Are there any limitations as to what I can call my variables? If so, what? You know, they're really, and then it's kind of like, okay, I've created it. Now, how do I call it back when I want to use it again? So it's like you come up with this set of kind of questions I've found. And again, this is me not knowing how to program, but that's what I'm learning as I look through more languages like Bash and Python and Lisp so far, and C++. You do, and one called processing as well, which I just learned about fairly recently, which is like a Java, sort of a simplified Java thing. You come up with like these, you know what's in store, you kind of know the ideas behind what you're doing, you just need to know how they want you to go about achieving these concepts. It's really, really interesting. Hopefully I will have a lot more to say about that at some point in the future. It might be another decade or so, but you never know. So the menu, I mean, I could, like I say, I could just read you the code, but it wouldn't really make that much of a difference. But it is really cool how Lisp and Emacs, they kind of, I know everyone says that Emacs is a Lisp interpreter, but it really is a Lisp interpreter. Seriously, it's a Lisp interpreter. It's not a text editor. You can enter text and you can do a bunch of stuff with that text, ridiculous amounts of manipulation with your text. I mean, to make yourself just so amazingly fast at typing and organizing, you know, cutting and pasting and swapping around text. It's amazing. But I mean, the thing that really, once you start manipulating your own .emacs file and you start writing your own little modes, you really, really get that. I mean, it's just, I don't know what the equivalent is anywhere. Like, you're building your own environment. I mean, it's as if though you had complete control. It's like one of those movies where you're in a holodeck or something, and you can just kind of call up whatever object you want, or you can change your landscape. I mean, it's exactly like that in Emacs, except on a much, much lesser scale. But I mean, it is, in a way, you're defining your own sort of text editing reality. So you can do things like define key space screenwriter mode map and then bracket menu dash bar close bracket make sparse key map, and then you can say, okay, well, let that menu map make sparse key map screenwriter, and define key screenwriter mode map as menu bar screenwriter cons screenwriter menu map. Makes total sense, am I right? Define key menu map trans, and that's transition. So then you do a single quote, paren, quote, transition, quote, space dot space screenwriter dash transition parent, things like that, which make utterly no sense unless you actually do a little bit of research into Lisp, which I don't feel like I'm quite qualified in even beginning to introduce you to, will literally make a new menu, like up where it says file, edit, options, buffers, tools, screenwriter. Oh, well, there it was, screenwriter now. Right before my help menu, there's a screenwriter menu, and in it is slugline, action, dialogue, transition, with the key maps included, like what they map to on the keyboard shortcuts, in this case, meta S, meta A, meta D, meta T, in that order. And it's just, it works. I mean, it's amazing. Can you imagine having literally an OS? I mean, I know the joke is that Emacs is an OS, but, and it kind of is, but can you imagine having an OS where you could do that sort of thing, where you would have that power, where you could just type some stuff into, like, a mode that you're creating for your OS, and suddenly you've got new menus and new icons and things like that? Well, of course, Linux is kind of like that. Depending on how deep you go, you could start creating your own plugins or components for KDE or GNOME or whatever. So actually, I guess we do have that. But it's really neat. It's super powerful. It's one of those things that, like, literally when I was first getting into Linux, that was one of the things. That was a big thing. I wanted to define, to be able to create the way that I, and control the way that I interfaced with my computing environment. And it was very, very difficult to do on any other platform, and now I'm finding it. I mean, I found it in Linux, but I'm finding it on a daily basis within all the different components that kind of make up Linux, like for me, like Emacs or KDE and things like that, where you can get in there and really, really change things around. So it's very cool. I urge you to check it out. And if you are into Emacs at all, then you may want to check out this guy's eLisp tutorial. I'd been to this site before. I wasn't really into it exactly. I mean, I like his content. I don't know that I really care for his mission. And it's called ergoemacs.org. So ergoemacs.org. And one of his big things, I guess, is kind of, he doesn't much care for the keyboard shortcuts of Emacs. And a lot of people do complain about that, like that Control X and Meta X kind of twisting your hands around to get to certain keys. My answer to that has always just been to remap the caps lock to be your control, and that seems to work pretty well for me. And I also find, and I've said this before, I think, but I find that typing in Emacs for me is a lot more like playing the piano, which sounds ridiculous, but it is. And then Vim, for instance, would be much more like a gamepad controller. So if you're thinking of like playing a game console with one of those controller pads, that to me is Vim, because there's sort of a key for every finger, and you never really take your fingers off of their pointed keys. I mean, that's not entirely true, obviously. I know that on certain controllers there are the D-pads or whatever, and you have to kind of move your thumb up to the D-pad or whatever they're called, joysticks, and move them around, and then you go back down to hit some different function keys. Point being that your hands are kind of, they're grasping onto this thing, and you're controlling the buttons one per finger mostly, and that's kind of how Vim feels, right? Because you never take your fingers off that home row. Whereas Emacs, you don't do that. Your hands are moving a lot more. They're moving around. They're in motion and they're dancing across the keyboard a lot more, kind of like on a piano or something. And that, I'm okay with that. That I like flamboyantly typing away. It makes me look smarter because my hands are like all over the place and people think that I'm really, really busy. Really, I'm just trying to like get something to be bold. So yeah, you check out Ergo Emacs. Check out his Emacs Lisp tutorial. It is a great tutorial. It is fascinating because it really breaks down the most basic concepts of eLisp just as a programming language. So it's not about Emacs per se, but it'll get you in Emacs, it'll get you into the scratch buffer, and it'll get you evaluating different statements, and you'll be doing arithmetic and Boolean things like true and false statements. You get so far as like if then and if then else statements. It's really, I think there's no while loop, but you could do like, you know, hacks around there not being a while loop. I could be wrong on that. Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure there's no while in eLisp. But the point being, it's really, really cool because you really start to see, if you look at this tutorial, even just the first page, you look at it and then you go back and look at a .emacs file or even one of the minor modes or I guess a major mode, whatever you want to look at in Emacs, and suddenly all that weird Lisp stuff makes a lot more sense. It becomes a lot more clear. You might not understand it exactly, but it's still a lot more sort of logical. So go read that site, go do the tutorial. It's really, really interesting, very, very fun. And it really does make eLisp a lot more, I find, accessible. I mean, and I've tried reading the Lisp or the eLisp manual from GNU. It's just way too, they're too smart for me. This breaks it down a lot better. So check it out for sure. It's very, very interesting. So that's about all the Emacs stuff I have for you. Let's take a coffee break. Coffee and Emacs, a great combination. I hope you're enjoying your cup of coffee. Sip on it a couple of times and get your mind back onto Linux, and let's talk about open source and EFI. Way back in Season 3, Episode 2, I was talking about the EFI shell. You can go check it out on gnuworldorder.info/audio/file/archive/season3/index3.html, in fact. There's the episode for you to listen to if you want to. But I was talking about EFI, and back then I feel like the whole UEFI thing was just starting to get kind of, it was still kind of a new thing, I think, if I recall correctly. Or maybe I was just not on the cutting edge, which is quite possible. But for me, I was at a job at that point where I was literally in the EFI shell on a daily basis. I wasn't doing a lot in the EFI shell. It was mostly, if I recall correctly, it was like flashing. Was I flashing? No, I was updating, I think, Yeah, I was updating ROM images, I'm pretty sure. I don't really exactly remember what I was doing. I do remember being in the EFI shell a lot. And you know, there were some quirks to it, and it was kind of interesting, and I had fun with it. I really did. I mean, I don't know much about the technology behind EFI. I mean, per se, not really. I understand a lot of the theory, but I don't understand, like, how all that stuff works at such a low level. But it's an interesting thing, because you know that it is important, because it does interface very directly and control what your motherboard is going to be able to do. So it's one of those important kinds of things. Well, at that time, there was a free EFI shell that was kind of gaining some traction. They were kind of getting their code together, I guess. And it was called, I think, Tiano or Tiano Core or something like that. So I don't remember it being Tiano Core at the time, but maybe it was. Either way, Tiano. T-I-A-N-O. And I don't remember it being something that you could really use yet, at least certainly it was well beyond my knowledge of how to use it, which, I mean, back in season 3, it's not saying a lot, but I remember it being not something that you could really play around with so much yet. I remember it being pretty rough around the edges at the time. So I was using Intel's EFI, which I didn't, I mean, I sensed that probably it being Intel probably wasn't super, you know, like free, as in free. It was probably kind of locked down. And then on top of Intel, there was like the other stuff that this company that I was working for at the time had put onto the EFI, like, to lock it down and stuff. So I wasn't all that really, like, into the concept of EFI necessarily, but I still, like I say, you still kind of know that it's important. Little did I know that it was going to become really important, because now, of course, all the computers are famously, I guess, shipping with, not all, but many of them are shipping with UEFI, Unified EFI. So that's kind of a hot topic right now, the new UEFI. You know, that's kind of, there's two separate issues, right? There's UEFI, and then there's what Microsoft crams into the UEFI so that it limits what you can do and so on. So EFI / UEFI in its on its own, I think, is really fascinating. All of the other stuff that companies bring to it, maybe not so interesting all the time, but it's still important. So the point is, if you want to experience an EFI shell for yourself, you finally can. And it's something that's completely emulatable at this point. You can look at this stuff in QEMU or KEMU and do some basic things. I mean, there's not a whole lot you can do in EFI unless you're either going to get into EFI like programming, where you're actually going to be building batch processes and things to load other things, you know. I mean, like, that's what BIOS and EFI and UEFI do, right? They wake up, they become aware of what chips they have available to them and what interfaces, and then they pass all that information on to the OS, which they launch. You know, they find the disk where this OS is, and they make sure that it boots to that thing. So, I mean, that's what EFI is. There's not a whole lot to do in EFI aside from that, but it's still kind of neat to kind of get in there and take a look at it. What you need to do in order to do this is to get an image of Tiano Core's UEFI firmware or whatever. This is how much I know about EFI. But http://sourceforge.net/apps/media/wiki/TianoCore, that's TianoCore/index.php ?title=OVMF. That is OVMF, and then return. And that should download the what they're calling OVMF image. Actually, it'll get you to that page, and you'll have two images to choose from. It'll get you can choose from the 32-bit EFI image or the 64-bit EFI image, and from there you can download the one that would be appropriate for your platform. Since you're emulating it, probably it doesn't really matter. So you'll get a zip file, and you can unzip this thing, and you'll have the omvf.fd and a Cirrus Logic 5446.rom. So you need to either rename or symlink omvf.fd to bios.bin, that's bios.bin, and move or copy your symlink or whatever Cirrus Logic 5446.rom to vgabios-cirrus.bin. Okay, so that's the first couple of steps, and then you can use QEMU. But in your QEMU command, you need to use an argument that will tell it where to look for the little BIOS images and stuff like that. So put the bios.bin and the vgabios.cirrus.bin into a folder. I put it into a folder called EFI. And then the command that you would run the QEMU for QEMU would be QEMU-system-x86_64, if you're doing 64-bit, which I am, /EFI, assuming that your EFI folder is right here in the same folder as you are, /BIOS/EFI/BIOS.bin. So you see what we're doing, right? We're telling it where to look for all the little bin files, and then we're specifically saying use this BIOS image when I launch this virtual machine, and then you can give it other usual QEMU commands like -m for memory, 1024, you don't need much for this, /CPU QEMU 64, and then return. That ought to get you a pretty basic virtual machine up and running pretty much right away. That'll launch a screen. You should see a nice little splash page or a splash image for Theano Core or whatever, and then you will find yourself pretty quickly at an EFI prompt. And that's it. You're in EFI now. That's an EFI shell. You can hit the question mark to see a list of commands. They will fly by your screen quicker than you can read them. I have not been able to find the key to stop them. So, and I think there is one, I just don't remember what it was, or maybe it doesn't exist in Theano, I don't know, or maybe the emulation isn't catching it, I'm not sure. Either way, if you go to download.intel.com/support/motherboards/server/sb/EFI_whitepaper.pdf, you will have a really, really good PDF document. If I recall correctly, this is the one that I actually read at the job that I was at to learn about this stuff in the first place, or something very like it. It looks very familiar to me. And it's got all the commands listed very, very nicely. It's got a bunch of information just on how to, well, program some things for EFI, how to interface with different media via EFI. Lots of good information. Really interesting read. You should definitely, whether or not you're interested in Intel's version of EFI or not, you should read this paper. It's really, really informative. Plus, I gather that Theano Core is basically, you know, using the Intel spec to do everything, because it looks and feels the same from my perspective, although, again, I'm not doing much in here at all. So anyway, let's close out your virtual machine for QEMU EFI shell, and then let's try making a drive, like a disk drive, and let's make it available to EFI. Now for this, the easiest way that I found to do this, you can do it obviously a variety of ways. I just put a thumb drive into my USB port, and I did a DD IF equals /dev/SDF, or wherever your thumb drive has been located. You can find that out, of course, via dmesg, D-M-E-S-G, pipe tail, and then OF equals EFI.img, and then /BS equals 24M. So that's just copying bit for bit the whole disk of whatever's plugged into dev SDF and dumping it into a file called EFI.image and the byte size of 24 megabytes, because why not? It makes it faster. Now we've got this disk image of a random thumb drive that I'm just using as a demonstration. So if you have a thumb drive lying around, you can do it that way. If you want to create your own disk image and partition it, whatever. Point is, you need to make the disk that you're going to feed EFI FAT16 or FAT32. It's got to be in those formats. Like it or not, that's what EFI can identify as a valid volume. Okay, so now we're going to launch QEMU again, but we're going to do it with some new arguments. So QEMU-system-x86_64/l.EFI-BIOS/EFI/BIOS.bin-m1024-CPU-QEMU64. Here's the important part, or another important part, /drive/file=.slash/EFI.image, IF=IDE. What this is telling QEMU is that we want our hard drive, such as it is, to be a file, or to be read from a file, which is EFI.img, because that's where I put it, and then IF, meaning interface, equals IDE. So this hard drive, now this file has become our hard drive on an IDE interface. Now at your, so now start QEMU with those commands. It fires up the EFI shell. You can look at the EFI shell, and you'll see possibly that it is now mapping locations to different buses. In other words, you'll see things like BLK0 will be aliased to such and such, and you'll if you keep reading it, you'll see that it's on the ATA bus. Things like that. This means that it has noticed your hard drive. It should do that after you boot the EFI shell. That should be the result. If it's not the result, you may be able to type in map space dash R, which refreshes the volume mapping of EFI. But generally speaking, if it hasn't auto found this in Kimu, it probably isn't. You're probably doing something wrong. If you're actually in a real live EFI shell and you plug in a thumb drive, then you could use map-r to then sort of detect that thumb drive. So the way that you get into a place in EFI, you don't mount it and then CD into wherever you mounted it. You just type in the location. So you do BLK0:, and then your prompt changes to BLK0:\, or whatever it is. Yeah, backslash, greater than symbol. And then you can do things like dir, D-I-R, and that will list the directory, and it'll tell you, okay, here's the directory of BLK0:\, and here's all the files on this thumb drive image that we've mounted. If this is a read and write drive, you could do things like make dir or touch. You can, I don't know, edit even, supposedly. I don't think I've edited yet in this emulated EFI, so I'm not sure. And the cool, sort of the farther out usage of all this, actually, as I've very recently discovered, is that in some computers that ship with UEFI, UEFI being the unified version of EFI, whatever that means, and you could go into the EFI interface. It may or may not look exactly like the BIOS interface. It could be like one of my motherboards with UEFI. It has a super like nice slick looking EFI interface. You can even use your mouse. It's really kind of weird. This newer computer that I'm using right now has, it looks exactly like BIOS, but you can go into it, and as one of the options, you can actually launch from that interface an EFI shell that you might have on a thumb drive or something, which in theory you should be able to do on any computer that runs EFI. But the vendors typically, at least one of the vendors that ship the most popular implementation so far of EFI, does not permit that. It doesn't let you do that. When it leaves the factory, they lock it up. You can't do that. But this computer that I have been using lately with UEFI actually allows you to boot into a shell right from, you know, you hit F2 to go into the UEFI interface, and then you can literally just say launch an EFI shell, point it to the EFI shell contained on some thumb drive, and you're up and running. So if you get an UEFI computer, be sure to check out any kind of options like that. In theory, you could program, I don't know, I mean, you learn enough about EFI programming, you could probably get your computer to do all kinds of cool tricks. But yeah, you can do things like that. Check out the different commands. That's it. You can check it out. It's really, really fun. It's super geeky. I mean, it's you'll look at it and you just won't know what to do. And that's an exciting, exciting moment. So try that. It's a lot of fun. Tiano Core EFI. Last but not least, I would like to talk about open source. What is open source? Well, I think we all know. I mean, we're all kind of in the community enough to kind of know what open source was. And interestingly, of all the different terms that we do use in, you know, for the software, to describe the software that we run, I kind of have always felt that open source was the more clear term, right? It's a very kind of obvious, self-defining nickname for this kind of software, I felt. I mean, I never really felt that the term free software was very descriptive. It's one of those terms, well, it's obviously very confusing, right? Or else we wouldn't have those weird sort of cult phrases that we all we chant every time we are trying to describe some software to someone. We always have to say things like, oh, well, it's free as in freedom, or oh, it's free as in beer, or it's libre, it's free but gratis. You know, it's like, it's horrible, it's terrible, terrible terminology, and nevertheless I respect it, and I appreciate that terminology, because I mean, I know that for myself, when I was first learning about this stuff, free software literally did just mean software that you didn't have to purchase, and that was a big deal for me, because I felt that was liberating. But then I read, I think it was the sort of some kind of README file that came along with Emacs, that was by, it was like an annotated GPL, I think, by Richard Stallman, where he was describing that the term free didn't actually just mean free, it meant something that you could share and build upon. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. I've never ever thought about that. I had no idea that's what programmers sort of did. I didn't know that's how it worked. So I mean, that was kind of one of those revelatory moments that I almost kind of wish everyone could have. You know, it's almost the payoff of the term free software, is that you don't really understand it, and then when you do understand what it truly means, then your world is kind of opened. You know, it's kind of all of your preconceived notions, or the fact that you had no notion of what was involved in software, in the world of programming, you just realize how ignorant you were, and you feel like you've really learned something. And it's a big moment, I think. I don't think everyone's going to get that, unfortunately, but I think if more people could, I think that is a powerful moment. But that's the payoff of the term free software, and it's not something that everyone's going to get. So I never felt that free software was a very clear term. It was something that you have to kind of investigate. You have to find out what it means. Whereas open source really, really did feel more like very self-explanatory, something that kind of describes itself. It's open source, meaning that it is open source, meaning that you can get the source code. You can open up the source code. You can look at it. You can see it. You can possibly maybe reuse it. I'm not really sure, because that's obviously where the term open source does fail. It doesn't actually describe the licensing scheme at all, but still, it is open source, right? Meaning that you can look at the code. You can open up the source. Seems pretty obvious. So this is a really interesting and wacky story that it seriously sounds like an urban legend or an old wives' tale, but it actually happened. So I got this email. It was a random sales email, which I get a lot at my current job. I get a lot of random IT-related emails from people who want to sell me on something so that I can then sell whoever in my organization has like the credit card to spend money on this thing, which is a joke because my organization doesn't have any money. We're like a nonprofit. There's no money. But anyway, they don't know that, so they email me all these things. So this one company emailed me about a backup solution, which, I mean, if you've ever listened to this show, you'll know how funny that is, because there are so many backup solutions out there for Unix. It's ridiculous, right? I mean, am I right or am I right? Flex backup. I've already talked about that. Backup, what is it? Backup my PC or PC backup or backup PC that Vulcan Rider told me about that I kind of used and then kind of didn't because it couldn't get it to work on a certain platform that I needed it to work on. Not Linux. It was a different one. There's rsync, of course. I talk about rsync a lot. I mean, there's just so many ways to backup stuff that does not involve proprietary software, really. That's not a place where Unix or Linux suffers at all. We've got backups, I feel, pretty well covered. So there's that email selling me on backup software. So I just kind of wrote back, because I like to write back. So I wrote back and said that we only use open source software at the organization, which of course is not true. But in my department, that's actually almost entirely true, except one file server that I just can't get rid of because it cost too much money. You can't just throw it away because it doesn't happen to run Linux. So generally speaking, it's actually true. So I said, we only use open source software. Do you have, is this open source? And so I sent that, and the salesperson said, yes, we do have an open source version. It's available at this download link. And I thought, wow, that's really, really interesting, because when I went to their site and looked at the backup solution, it did not look like an open source friendly solution at all. I mean, it looked very proprietary, very not open source. So I was really surprised. So I went to the download link, and sure enough, there's a free, as in no cost, version available for download. And I thought, well, that's weird. That's not a source download at all. That's the download of the software without support. So I clicked on the download link. It tries to download a .exe. So it's not even my platform. It's not a source zip file or a tarball of source code. It's an executable. It's a binary file. And so I email the person back and say, we audit all of our code here, which, you know, again, not entirely true. We audit all of our code here. Where is the source code download? And then the final email from this is the salesperson's supervisor, writing me back saying, this is a proprietary solution. We don't have a source code. We don't have the source code available. So I thought, how completely bizarre that this salesperson literally obviously thought that when I said open source, I meant $0. I'd never ever, I mean, I think I've heard people say that happens, but I've never had that happen to me. Someone literally thinking that the term open source means you're not charged for it. I've never heard that before. I mean, is that for real? Is that actually what people think open source means? I mean, that's horrible. And this is, I mean, this is, granted, this is a salesperson, not a, like a tech support person. So this is like the person sending out 50 emails a day to random people saying, hi, we have backup software for your PC. And they, and in this person's mind, I'm sure that that means that you're running Windows and that you need backup, and that if you can, if she can make, if this person can make a sale, then they're going to get a commission. And in the end, it turned out that, you know, she, the person was totally trying to sell me on the wrong platform anyway, and that open source didn't mean $0. But I mean, it's really, really interesting to me that someone would mistake the term open source for I want to download something for free and not even provide this. I mean, and get it so wrong that, that there's just no way you're ever going to get the source code of this program. I mean, that was just not even an option, but that was how it was taken. So I'm not saying that this is a problem or a big deal or anything. I guess the larger lesson would be, oh, we need to make more people aware of what open source truly means. But I mean, who cares? If people don't know what open source means, then people don't know what open source means. It's not really something that you can, you know, I mean, there are larger issues in the world than to try to spread the word or whatever. I have a bunch of stickers on my laptop. If people can't figure it out, then that's their problem. They can go to websites, they can read. So yeah, I mean, it was a random salesperson. I just never had anyone make that mistake before. That was such a weird mistake. I mean, yes, misinterpreting like my request for free software, meaning that I want something that I can redistribute versus something that I can just look at the source code. I can see the misunderstanding there, but literally thinking the term open source means I don't want to pay for something is just, that just boggled my mind when it actually happened to me in real life. I just thought, wow, that is really, really uninformed and bad. You know, it's just that's a bad thing. And it does, I guess, harken back to that sort of that cliche, which I really believe most of us find to be wrong, and that is that people who are into like open source don't want to pay for anything. And I know we all have anecdotal stories of how we've spent money on this and money on that, even though it was offered for free, or even though whatever. You know, I mean, we've all said it. We all go through different stages in life, right? I mean, at one point I was poor enough literally to not be able to pay for the free software that I was downloading and using. And that's okay. It's free software, and it's also free software. There's that term again. And that's fine. And when you need to do that, you can do that. But then at some point, maybe you're not that poor and you find that you've been living, you know, in a server room for a year. And so you've started to accumulate some money in the bank. And so you're like, well, maybe I could afford to subscribe to Slackware.com. To Slackware so that I can get a physical disk of Slackware every time it updates itself. Maybe I could donate to, you know, this project or that project that I use on a daily basis. So you start to pay for things, even though they're not requiring you to do so. So wherever you may be personally in that sort of spectrum of yes, I can pay, no, I cannot pay, or I won't pay because I don't believe in paying, or whatever, it doesn't really matter. The point is that a lot of us, I think, agree and are aware that free software is something that many of us will spend money on because it's something we care about. And we understand that in this world, there's an economy, and that if we don't support the people writing the code that we really, really love to use, then that code may go away. So if we can help support that in very direct kind of monetary ways, then we do. So it's ridiculous. The cliche is ridiculous that open source people won't pay for stuff. It's just, it's silly. It really is ridiculous. I do understand the problem of, oh, we must force people to pay versus, well, if we don't force them, then they won't pay and we won't make enough. I understand the economics of it. And I know that that exists. And it's, I guess, a pity that it exists. But in terms of the assumption that open source means people don't want to pay for something, I think is really, really ridiculous. I don't think it's a fair assumption at all. Of course, I'm preaching to the choir. You already know this. But I guess, hey, it's a real thing. People actually do think that. I'm now convinced, or I see that they do, because I've gotten those emails and I see that literally my request for open source rendered a proprietary download of something that I didn't have to pay money for. Weird, huh? Okay, that's it for this episode. Thank you for listening. I will talk to you next week.
that's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware, any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
Volunteers, we're going to teach some of the audience how to do this again.